Chapter 5. Harmageddon. Eru, a.k.a. the Foul Estate. Buried in a descending spiral around the lock, the berserkers grew agitated as magic was let loose in the world above. Something was coming, Oro, captain of the berserkers, realized. Soon we will be free and our swords will taste human blood once more. We will bake their hearts in clay jars, and call forth the ancient dark forces. We will infiltrate what forms we must to hold the humans back. They cannot kill us, for we are already dead, held together by a skein of magic. Our time will be short, no more than a single night after all this time, but we will cover ourselves in glory and blood before we join Danu in the afterlife. Can you feel the shift? Oro called down to the spirits of his warriors. Be prepared to push forward when the gate is opened.
We are ready, replied his warriors. When the light falls upon us, we will seize the bodies of dogs, badgers, and humans, and subvert them to our wills.
Oro could not help thinking, I would rather inhabit a human than a badger. For he was proud, and this pride had cost him his life 10,000 years ago. Gobdor, who lay to his left, sent out a shuddering thought, but could almost be a chuckle. Yes, he said, but better a badger than a rat. If Oro's heart had been flesh and blood, it would have burst with a new pride, but this time for his warriors. My soldiers are ready for war. They will fight until their stolen bodies drop, then finally be free to embrace the light. Our time is at hand. Juliet Butler was holding the fort, and not just in the sense of looking after things while Artemis's parents were away at an eco-conference in London. She was actually holding a fort. The fort in question was an old Martello tower that stood sentry on a hill overlooking Dublin Bay. The fort had been worn down to a nub by the elements, and strange black ivy had thrown tendrils along the walls, as though trying to reclaim the stone for the earth. The would-be conquerors were Artemis Fowl's brothers, 4-year-old Miles and his twin, Beckett. The boys had rushed the tower several times with wooden swords, but were rebuffed by Juliet, and sent gently tumbling into the long grass. Beckett squealed with laughter, but Juliet could see that Miles was growing more and more frustrated at the failure of his assaults. Just like Artemis, that one, Juliet thought. Another little criminal mastermind. For the past 10 minutes, the boys had been rustling behind a bush, plotting their next attack. Juliet could hear muffled giggles and terse commands, as Miles no doubt issued a complicated series of tactical instructions to Beckett. Juliet smiled. She could just imagine the scenario. Miles would say something like,
You go one way, Beck, and I'll go the other. It's called flanking.
To which Beckett would respond with something like,
I like caterpillars.
It was true to say that the brothers loved each other, more than they loved themselves. But Miles lived in a state of constant frustration that Beckett could not, or would not, follow the simplest instruction.
Any second now, Beckett will grow bored with this tactical meeting, thought Butler's younger sister,
and come wandering from the bush, brandishing his toy sword. Moments later, Beckett did indeed stumble from the bush, but it was not a sword that he brandished. Juliet swung her leg over the low parapet and called suspiciously,
Beck, what have you got there?
Beckett waved the item.
Underpants,
he said frankly. Juliet looked again to confirm that the grubby triangle was indeed a pair of underpants. Because of the knee-length Wimpy Kid t-shirt he had worn for the past 48 days, it was impossible to ascertain whether or not the underpants were Beckett's own, though it seemed likely, given that the boy's legs were bare. Beckett was something of an unruly character, and, in her few months as nanny bodyguard, Juliet had seen a lot worse things than underpants. For example, the worm farm that Beckett had constructed in the downstairs bathroom and fertilized personally.
Okay, Beck, she called down from the tower. Just put the underpants down, kiddo. I'll get you a clean pair.
Beckett advanced steadily.
Nope. Beckett is sick of stupid underpants. These are for you. A present.
The boy's face glowed with innocent enthusiasm, convinced that his wife fronts were about the best present a girl could get. Besides, a pair of his wife fronts with a handful of beetles cradled inside. Juliet countered with,
But it's not my birthday.
Beckett was at the foot of the worn tower now, waving the pants like a flag.
I love you, Jules. Take the present.
He loves me, thought Juliet. Kids always know the weak spot. She tried one last desperate ploy.
But won't your bottom be chilly?
Beckett had an answer for that.
Nope. I don't ever feel cold.
Juliet smiled fondly. It was easy to believe. Bony Beckett gave off enough heat to boil a lake. Hugging him was like hugging a restless radiator. At this point, Juliet's only way to avoid touching the underpants was a harmless lie.
Rabbits love old underpants, Beck. Why don't you bury them as a gift for Papa Rabbit?
Rabbits don't need underpants,
said a sinister little voice behind her.
They're warm-blooded mammals, and their fur is sufficient clothing in our climate.
Juliet felt the tip of Miles's wooden sword in her thigh, and realized that the boy had used Beckett as a distraction, then circled around to the back steps.
I didn't hear a thing, she mused. Miles is learning to creep.
Very good, Miles, she said. How did you get Beckett to follow your instructions?
Miles grinned smugly, and the resemblance to Artemis was uncanny.
I didn't give him soldier's orders. I suggested to Beck that his bum might be itchy.
The boy is not yet 5, thought Juliet.
Wait till the world gets a load of Miles Fowl. From the corner of her eye, she saw something triangular sail through the air toward her and instinctively snatched it. No sooner had her fingers closed on the material than it dawned on her what she was holding.
Great, she thought, hoodwinked by 2 4-year-olds. Right-o, boys, she said. Time to go back to the house for lunch. What's on the menu today?
Miles sheathed his sword.
I would like a croque madame, with chilled grape juice.
Bugs,
said Beckett, hopping on one foot.
Bugs in ketchup.
Juliet hiked Miles onto her shoulder and jumped down from the tower's low wall.
Same as yesterday, then, boys.
Memo to self, she thought. Wash your hands.
The boys were waist-high in the pasture when the faraway chaos began. Beckett paid the sudden distant cacophony little attention, as his internal soundtrack generally featured explosions and screaming. But Miles knew something was wrong. He headed back to the Martello Tower and clambered up the stone steps, displaying a lack of motor skills reminiscent of Artemis, which amused Beckett greatly, as he was sure-footed to the same extent his brothers were not.
Armageddon!
Miles announced when he reached the top step.
The end of the world!
Beckett was dismayed.
Not Disneyland, too?
Juliet ruffled his sun-bleached hair. No, of course not Disneyland. In her stomach, she felt a growling of disquiet. Where were these noises coming from? It sounded as though there was a war zone nearby. Juliet followed Miles to the compacted mud floor on top of the tower. From there, they had a clear view down into the distant city. Usually the only sounds to ride the breeze this far north were the occasional beeps of traffic-jammed horns from cars stuck on the ring road. But today, the highway to Dublin seemed more like the road to hell. Even from this distance, it was clear that the 6 lanes of traffic had come to a complete stop. Several engines exploded as they watched, and a pickup truck threw an unexpected forward flip. Farther into the city, bigger explosions rumbled from behind buildings, and smoke belches drifted into the afternoon sky, a sky that had troubles of its own, as a small aircraft landed in the center of a soccer stadium, and an honest-to-God communication satellite dropped from space like a dead robot onto the roof of the U2 hotel. Beckett climbed the steps and took Juliet's hand.
It's Armageddon, he said quietly. The world is going boom.
Juliet pulled the boys close. Whatever was developing seemed too big to be directed specifically at the Fowl family, though there was a growing list of people who would happily destroy the entire county of Dublin just to get at Artemis.
Don't worry, boys, she said. I will protect you.
She reached into her pocket. In situations like this, where things were violently weird, the first course of action was always the same. Call Artemis. She scrolled through the list of networks on her phone and was not overly surprised to see that the only available one was the Fox system that Artemis had set up for emergency secure calls. I imagine that Artemis is the only teenager in the world to have built and launched his own satellite. She was about to select Artemis's name from her contacts when a bulky forearm appeared in space 10 feet in front of her. There was a hand at the end of the arm, and it clutched a fairy neutrino blaster.
99, Mudwinch, said a voice from nowhere,
and a blue bolt of crackling power erupted from the tip of the weapon. Juliet was familiar enough with fairy weapons to know that she would survive a blue bolt, but that she would probably suffer a contact burn and wake up inside a cocoon of pain.
Sorry, my boys, she thought. I have failed you.
Then the bolt from Pip's weapon hit her in the chest, scorched her jacket, and knocked her from the tower. Oro of the Berserkers felt a moment of doubt. Perhaps this anticipation of freedom is merely a yearning, he thought. No, this was more than his own longing. The key was coming. He could feel the rush of power as it approached their tomb.
Gather yourselves, he sent down to his warriors. When the gate is open, take whatever shape you must. Anything that lives or has lived can be ours.
Oro felt the earth shake with the roar of his warriors. Or perhaps that was mere yearning.